Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK World Radio Japan, France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with NHK World Radio Japan. The Prime Minister of New Zealand offered a national apology to hundreds of thousands of children and the elderly who were abused in institutions over the past 70 years. Israeli media say that Netanyahu now admits his government was behind the exploding pager attacks in Lebanon. The Guardian newspaper has ceased posting on X, which it has called a toxic platform. The COP29 United Nations Climate Change Conference opened this week in Azerbaijan. The conference president called for unity and to recognize that climate change is already here despite corporate denial. The goal is to get developed countries to aid poorer developing ones. NHK Japan.
New Zealand's Prime Minister has offered a national apology to hundreds of thousands of children and vulnerable adults who were abused in institutions over the past 70 years.
It was horrific. It was heartbreaking. It was wrong, and it should never have happened. For many of you, it changed the course of your life, and for that, the government must take responsibility.
An estimated 200,000 people in state care and faith-based institutions in New Zealand were subjected to physical, mental, and sexual abuse between 1950 and 2019. That's according to a report released in July by a public inquiry. Many of those abused were from the indigenous Maori community. The report came after people who lived in such institutions filed a lawsuit against the government and other authorities for apology and compensation on their suffering. The Prime Minister said the government will create a redress system for survivors. A National Remembrance Day will also take place in November next year. Israeli media say Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has admitted his government was behind a series of detonations of handheld communication devices across Lebanon in September. Israeli media say Netanyahu made the admission at a cabinet meeting Sunday. It was reportedly the first time the Israeli government has acknowledged its involvement in the operation, which targeted members of Hezbollah. In September, pagers and other communication devices exploded across Lebanon, leaving about 40 people dead and over 3,400 injured. Hezbollah said some of its members were killed. Netanyahu reportedly said the operation and the killing of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah were launched despite the opposition of some senior officials. France's AFP news agency and other media also reported the Prime Minister has confirmed he greenlit the pager operation. One of Britain's major newspapers is ending its run on X. The Guardian says it'll no longer post from any official editorial accounts on what it calls a toxic platform. The Guardian is known for its left-leaning tone. The paper says it made the decision because X often promotes or hosts disturbing content, including far-right conspiracy theories and racism. It also says owner Elon Musk uses the social media site to shape political discourse, citing the recent U.S. presidential election campaign. Musk responded by calling The Guardian a vile propaganda machine. This is not the first time X's neutrality has been questioned in the U.K. Recently, several British police forces and at least one university said they would review or halt their use of X. That's after posts containing false information fueled anti-immigrant anger and triggered widespread rioting.
The COP29 United Nations Climate Change Conference has opened in Azerbaijan amid uncertainties over U.S. cooperation following Donald Trump's election win. The annual meeting began Monday in the capital, Baku. The conference president stressed the international community should unite to fulfill an ambitious goal.
Colleagues, we are on the road to ruin. But these are not the future problems. Climate change is already here. COP29 is an unmissable moment to chart a new path forward for everyone.
A key topic will be deciding fundraising targets from developed countries and to help developing nations address climate change starting in 2025. U.S. President Joe Biden returned the country to the 2015 Paris Agreement on climate change after Trump withdrew. The president-elect has also spoken out against a set of U.S. environmental protection proposals while calling for more oil production.
I will terminate the Green New Scam immediately. Drill, baby, drill.
Concerns are spreading among participating countries about the U.S. response to global warming.
I hope the U.S. doesn't leave the Paris Agreement. We shouldn't forget the U.S. is a major greenhouse gas emitter. It would be very difficult without them.
We're running out of funds, we're running out of time, and for us to not go ambitiously towards the required finance targets, we're just going to miss it and have, like, catastrophic climate change, and we just can't afford that.
COP29 will continue through November 22nd.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they're heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp, as well as most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. All the times I announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. On to France 24. A report on the financial assistance that organizers hope to create at COP29. Developing countries will need $1 trillion annually to adapt to climate change and to bring their pollution into line with the goals of the Paris Accords. $1 trillion is 1% of the global GDP. It's also 1 year of pure profit for the fossil fuel industry. France 24.
The COP29 summit is being held in Baku, Azerbaijan this week, and this year's event has been dubbed the Finance COP. Negotiators must increase a $100 billion a year target to help developing nations prepare for the worsening impacts of climate change and wean their economies off fossil fuels. How much is to be on offer and who will pay for it are the two major points of contention. To talk to us about that, Valerie de Camp, our environment editor, with me now. Valerie, first of all, we have this existing target then of $100 billion US dollars annually. I just mentioned that. If negotiations are successful, the new goal could reach $1 trillion. Why are we seeing such a big jump?
Well, the $100 billion target a year was never adequate in the first place. It was a promise made in 2009, but there was never any economic reasoning behind it. It was just an arbitrary number. Since then, economists have worked to assess what it would cost to face the climate crisis, and they came up with a number. $2.4 trillion U.S. dollars every single year would be needed for developing countries, excluding China, to cut their greenhouse gas emissions and also adapt to the consequences of global warming. They say that of that sum, about half could come from countries' own domestic budgets and also domestic investments. And that would leave roughly $1 trillion U.S. dollars coming from developed nations.
The UN climate chief, though, is insisting this isn't charity, this money. Why is the new goal so important?
It's obviously a climate justice question. Developing nations did not cause the climate crisis in the first place. Wealthy nations did. And so you can understand why developing nations today are saying, hang on, you know, you've become rich with your fossil fuel powered economies. You're asking us to stop using what made you rich, but not helping in the process. So in order to address the climate crisis, you need everyone on board. And so you need to provide that financial aid. And just to give you an example, developed countries, they have access to capital markets. Developing nations, it's a lot more expensive. And so an example of that is that Africa has about 60% of the best solar resources in the world. And yet you have, you know, some European countries, Belgium, the Netherlands, Poland, not necessarily known for their sunshine, they have installed more solar panels than the whole of sub-Saharan Africa in 2023. Why? Because it costs a lot more money to actually install solar panels in Africa because the cost of capital is higher.
And Valerie, this $1 trillion figure, can it actually be delivered? Where's the money from that likely to come from?
Well, it sounds huge, $1 trillion, but it's actually 1% of global GDP. It's also a year of pure profit for the fossil fuel industry. For the last 50 years, on average, they've made $1 trillion every single year. And so the money does exist. It's a question of it's a political question. So no developed country, as we stand, is ready to commit to a specific figure as long as we don't expand the donor base of who actually contributes. Other countries that are also quite wealthy and polluting. So, for example, you know, the group of countries obliged to actually provide climate finance, that list was prepared in 1992. The world economy has changed massively since then. You have emerging economies like China, South Korea, a lot richer than they used to be. They pollute a lot more. They're still considered developing petrostates. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, also considered developing nations, although they have amassed vast oil wealth. So it's another kind of climate justice question. Should only historical high emitters contribute, or should we open up the donor base? China has been very clear that they don't want to give up on their developing status.
Just a final question then. If countries aren't going to pay, who will?
Economists say that much of the funding will not actually come from taxpayers' money in the West. It's actually multilateral development banks like the World Bank, the IMF. We are looking at about $200 to $400 billion a year in the form of low interest loans, but that will require sweeping reform, so it will take time. And there's the other idea of global taxes, solidarity taxes being increasingly discussed. So, for example, a 2% wealth tax on billionaires. This is a Brazilian proposal. They have shown that just with 100 billionaire families in Brazil alone, you could potentially raise more than $250 billion every single year. And then you obviously have taxes on polluting industries, shipping, aviation, financial transactions, and that could generate about $900 billion by 2030. But it will, again, require a specific global agreement. The most likely scenario at COP is that we will reach an estimate at around, you know, a couple of billions of public funding, the rest having to come from private investments. But if you think about the fact that developed countries were never able to achieve their promise of providing $100 billion only by 2020, you can understand that it's going to be a massive challenge to get to $1 trillion.
Valerie De Camp, our environment editor.
That report and interview were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They're also available at most podcast sites. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The Biden administration promised to cut off weapons to Israel if they did not allow more aid into Gaza within 30 days. Aid agencies say that even less aid is getting through now than when the war began. Professor Michael Link, former UN Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, discusses the situation and how the Trump presidency might change things. EU Foreign Affairs Chief Joseph Borrell proposed suspending EU-Israeli political dialogue over breaches of international law. Radio Deutsche Welle.
A group of eight international aid agencies say Israel has failed to meet U.S. demands to allow more aid into Gaza. Last month, the Biden administration gave Israel 30 days to increase urgently needed aid for the territory or risk a scaling back of American military support. Well, that deadline expires today. So how much aid is getting into Gaza, and have the past 30 days seen any improvements?
Displaced Palestinians in central Gaza queue for a bowl of lentil soup, a rare hot meal that in many cases will have to feed an entire extended family. The war has destroyed Gaza's farming and fishing industries, leaving the entire population of 2.2 million reliant on food aid. The UN's World Food Programme is the biggest supplier of aid, followed by the Egyptian Red Crescent. Israel records all of the aid it allows into Gaza. Here are Israel's monthly statistics for 2024. They show deliveries dropped in October to their lowest level since the start of the war. Early November saw an improvement, but still way below what the US has called for. Washington wants aid for Gaza to rise to 350 trucks a day. The daily average for October was just 57 trucks, excluding fuel deliveries. UN agencies say even less actually gets distributed due to Israeli restrictions, ongoing fighting, and the general chaos. Things are especially bad in the north. Residents in the towns of Jabalia, Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun say they've received no aid at all since Israel began a new offensive there on October 5th. The Israeli army says it was forced to move into the towns to take on Hamas militants, who it says have regrouped there. One man in Jabalia told reporters that most of his family were killed in a strike at the weekend.
This is the bread that they wanted to eat for breakfast. What good is bread if there's no safety or peace? We don't want food, bread or flour. We want safety and peace.
The UN estimates that between 75 and 95,000 people are in northern Gaza, living in dire conditions. Last week, thousands followed Israeli army orders to evacuate Beit Lahia. A UN-backed panel says famine is imminent in northern Gaza, an assessment dismissed as inaccurate by Israel.
Let's get some context here from Michael Link, a professor of law at Western University in Ontario, Canada, and previously a UN special rapporteur on the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territories. So this deadline for the increase of aid has now expired. The big question is, do you think the Biden administration will, in response, limit military support to Israel?
This remains to be seen. We've witnessed over the past year a number of reports that Israel, in the conduct of its military assault on Gaza, has been breaking international law, committing the allegations of war crimes and crimes against humanity, and of course, even genocide. And that hasn't stopped American aid from flowing, even despite internal reports within the State Department saying that Israel is violating international law, and therefore that should demand the cutoff of weaponry. I take it that the letter sent a month ago by the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State was quite serious. They were expecting to see Israel bring up its allowance of daily humanitarian trucks entering into Gaza up to 350. Indeed, aid organizations say that itself is insufficient. What is needed is around 600 trucks daily going in. As your reporters have said, in October, the average was only 57 trucks. And indeed, that has fallen to only 22 trucks a day entering into Gaza in the first week of November. So my instinct would be is that the United States would want to show that it's going to back up its word, that it will take steps if Israel hasn't fulfilled the humanitarian demands of the United States. And we're waiting for that announcement sometime in the next day coming from Washington.
Who is in charge of ensuring that these laws are implemented? What happens if they're not respected?
Ultimately, this is an executive decision of the American government that usually is in the hands of the Secretary of State. It always could be overruled by the president. But ordinarily, it's the Secretary of State who determines if the Leahy Act, which is the primary piece of American legislation that would govern the flow of weapons to a country who is alleged to be violating international law, would determine it. As I've said, you know, there have been reports that internally there was allegations that Israel had committed violations of international law, thereby triggering the Leahy Act that was overruled by the Secretary of State. But I suspect we've probably seen his patience thinned over the last month by Israel's inability or refusal to allow sufficient humanitarian aid to enter into Gaza.
Now, also important to note, of course, that this was a deadline set by the Biden administration before the U.S. presidential election. We've got President-elect Donald Trump coming into office, who has indicated he would give Israel perhaps even freer rein. Do you think this Trump administration would be likely to ignore or reverse any decision that Biden might put forward?
One wonders, you know, if you look at the number of things that the first Trump administration had given Israel with respect to moving the American embassy to Jerusalem, the cutting off of aid to the Palestinian Authority, the cutting off of aid to UNRWA, the recognition of the Israeli claim of sovereignty over the Syrian Golan Heights, and the ending of the Iranian nuclear deal. Very few of those were reversed by the Biden administration. The biggest issue will be whether or not the demand coming from Israel for a green light from Washington to annex parts of the parts or all of the West Bank will be heeded by the new Trump administration. This, I think, would be a grave worry by Israel's traditional allies in Europe, and it would meet with great opposition, I think, coming from the global south. One wonders if so much was given to Israel in the first Trump administration, how much more generous it will be in the second administration.
Professor Link, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. That is Professor Michael Link from Western University in Ontario.
Now, diplomatic sources have confirmed to DW that the European Union's outgoing foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, has proposed the bloc to suspend political dialogue with Israel. In a letter to EU foreign ministers, he cites serious concerns about possible breaches of international humanitarian law in Gaza. Europe's top diplomat argues Israel has not sufficiently addressed these concerns. A suspension would need approval from all EU member states. Foreign ministers are expected to discuss the proposal at their meeting on Monday, the last one that Borrell chairs before ending his five-year term.
That interview and report were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They're also available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, like listeners in Toronto, Canada, and Ukiah and Willits, California did this week, there is a link for online donations available at my website address, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. Please join in. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please, they need your support as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Iran says that Israel should be expelled from the United Nations for the wars in Palestine and Lebanon. Pegasus is spyware blacklisted by the U.S. in 2021 for its use to spy on journalists, opposition politicians, and activists. Colombia alleges that the U.S. financed an $11 million purchase for the spyware to be installed in Colombia in 2021. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Iran says the time is ripe for Israel's expulsion from the United Nations amid the regime's genocidal war in Gaza and its aggression against Lebanon. Qasem Gharibabadi, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Legal and International Affairs, made these remarks while addressing the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC Arab League Foreign Ministers meeting in Rayyah on Sunday. The meeting aimed to discuss Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians and was held in advance of an emergency summit scheduled for Monday today. He said the time has come for it to expel Israel from the United Nations because of the regime's hostile actions against the legitimacy of the United Nations, including the tearing of its charter, declaring the world body Secretary-General persona non grata, and banning the activities of the UNRWA in the occupied territories. Gharibabadi added that Israel should be expelled from the United Nations given the regime's killing of hundreds of United Nations employees, its complete disregard for the temporary orders of the International Court of Justice, and violation of the provisions of the United Nations Charter. The Iranian diplomat described the ongoing developments in the Gaza Strip and Lebanon as a, quote, shame for humanity and a double injustice against a nation that has been under occupation and aggression and deprived of its basic rights for more than 7 decades. He said the United States and Western countries have been providing the Israeli regime with unwavering support to commit war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, racial discrimination, and genocide against the defenseless Palestinian people. Quote, as an illegitimate child of the West, the Zionist regime has been spared from any accountability and responsibility for its crimes. This according to Gary Babadi.
In a story released in Washington regarding the scandal over the use of Pegasus spyware in Colombia, the Colombian ambassador to the United States said that he still has many doubts about the use of the program. He affirmed that he has asked U.S. authorities for information on the data collected during its use in the South American country. After learning more information about the spy software, Ambassador Daniel Garcia Peña had a meeting with the Director of National Security for Western Hemisphere Affairs, Dan Erickson, to address the implications and clarify the role of Washington in the operation. Upon leaving the meeting, the Colombian diplomat said the U.S. officials confirmed to him that American resources were used for the decision of the Pegasus software and that they were indeed done on the dates that have been reported. The Colombian diplomat indicated that the White House claimed that the software was used to fight drug trafficking, but the dividing government decided to suspend its use in the face of imminent dangers. He also said that there was supervision by U.S. authorities to supposedly ensure that it was only directed against people linked to drug trafficking. For their part, U.S. officials revealed that few security officials were aware of it, and Washington did not inform President Duque about it or his successor, Gustavo Petro. The Colombian Prosecutor's Office opened an investigation last September into the purchase of the spy software, which, according to what the Justice Minister Angela Maria Buitrago said on his social network X, has to continue until the conclusions are known. In October, President Gustavo Petro said that executives of the Israeli company NSO Group, creator of Pegasus, transported $11 million in cash by plane.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu. There's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Standard Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look even harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Find information for online donations. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link. And get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 20th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house that's connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.